of the notion that the white race is superior or entitled to special privileges because of race. By August 1963, 78% of white Americans believed that racial discrimination had harmed the United States' reputation abroad. But not many inside or outside of the Kennedy administration were willing to admit that the growing groundswell of support in Washington for strong civil rights legislation had more to do with winning the Cold War in Africa and Asia than with helping African Americans. Southern segregationists cited those foreign interests in their opposition. South Carolina Senator Strom Thurmond refused to act on some particular measure because of the threat of communist propaganda if we don't, as he fired at Rusk. Kennedy's introduction of civil rights legislation did not stop the momentum of the long-awaited March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom. Though it had been organized by civil rights groups, the Kennedy administration controlled the event, ruling out civil disobedience. Kennedy aides approved the speakers and speeches, a lineup that did not include a single black woman, or James Baldwin, or Malcolm X. On August 28th, approximately 250,000 activists and reporters from around the world marched to the area between the Lincoln Memorial and the Washington Monument. Before Kennedy officials happily read the USIA's report saying that numerous foreign newspapers contrasted the opportunity to march that had been granted by a free society with a despotic suppression practiced by the USSR, and before King ended the round of approved speeches with his rousing and indelible anti-racist dream of children one day living in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character, and before Mahalia Jackson sang into the blazing throng of approved placards and television cameras, the NAACP's Roy Wilkins came as the bearer of sad news. W.E.B. Du Bois had died in his sleep the previous day in Ghana, Wilkins announced. Regardless of the fact that in his later years Dr. Du Bois chose another path, Wilkins intoned, it is incontrovertible that at the dawn of the 20th century, his was the voice calling you to gather here today in this cause. The well-trained journalist at the helm of the NAACP reported the truth. Indeed, the younger Du Bois had called for such a gathering, hoping it would persuade and endear millions to the lowly souls of black folk. And yes, the older Du Bois had chosen another path, the anti-racist path less traveled, toward forcing millions to accept the equal souls of black folk. It was the path of civil disobedience that the young marchers in the SNCC and Corps had desired for the March on Washington, a path a young woman from Birmingham's Dynamite Hill was already marching upon and would never leave. Roy Wilkins did not dwell on the different paths. Looking out at the lively March on Washington, he solemnly asked for a moment of silence to honor the 95-year movement of a man. Part 5. Angela Davis. Chapter 30. The Act of Civil Rights. Summer tourists had already left the gaudy beachside casinos in Biarritz by the time she arrived for her junior year in France program. She had come a long way from her hometown of Birmingham and her Brandeis University campus outside of Boston. On September 16, 1963, Angela Davis walked with classmates in Biarritz and skimmed a Herald Tribune. She noticed a headline about four girls dying from a church bombing. It did not hit her at first. Then suddenly, it registered. She stopped, closing her eyes in disbelief as her puzzled companions looked on. She pointed to the article. "I know them," she spluttered out. "They're my friends." Avoiding her classmates and their perfunctory condolences, Davis kept staring at the familiar names in sadness and rage. Cynthia Wesley, Carol Robertson, Carol Denise McNair, Addie Mae Collins. The only deceased girl Angela Davis did not know personally was Addie Mae. Angela's mother, Sally, had taught Denise in the first grade. The Robertson and Davis families had been close friends as long as she could remember. The Wesleys lived around the block in the hilly Birmingham neighborhood where Angela grew up. Angela had been 4 years old when her parents, Sally and B. Frank Davis, had desegregated that neighborhood in 1948. White families began moving out as black families moved in. Some stayed and violently resisted. Because of white resistors' bombing of black homes, the neighborhood was often called Dynamite Hill. But the bombings did not deter Angela's parents, especially her mother. Sally Davis had been a leader in the Southern Negro Youth Congress, an anti-racist, Marxist organization that protested against economic exploitation and racial discrimination in the late 1930s and 1940s, drawing the admiration of W.E.B. Du Bois. On Dynamite Hill, Sally and her husband nurtured Angela on a steady diet of anti-capitalist and anti-racist ideas. And so, when Angela started the first grade, she was struck by the inequities at lunchtime. Hungry children without enough food had to sit there and watch other children eat. Like her mother, she gave to the hungry children. She grew up detesting the poverty all around her, and she grew up detesting the poverty of the assimilationist ideas all around her, deciding very early that I would never, and I was categorical about this, never harbor or express the desire to be white. She ventured north in the fall of 1959 to attend an integrated high school in Manhattan, where her history teachers nurtured her to socialism. She joined a youth organization called Advance and picketed a Woolworths in solidarity with a rash of Southern sit-ins in the spring of 1960. Davis stayed in the North for college, enrolling as one of the few black students at Brandeis University in 1961. She wanted to continue her activism, but Brandeis's white campus activists alienated her. It seemed as if they were determined to help the poor, wretched Negroes become equal to them, and I simply didn't think they were worth becoming equal to, she remembered. Davis found other outlets. She attended the Eighth World Festival for Youth and Students in Helsinki, Finland, in the summer of 1962. When one of her favorite authors came for a lecture at Brandeis in October 1962, Davis captured a front-row seat. James Baldwin was nearing the publication of his luminous 1963 book for activists critical of the civil rights movement's integrationist, persuasion, and nonviolent thrusts. He titled the manifesto, The Fire Next Time, with an epigraph quoting an African-American spiritual to put the title in context. God gave Noah the rainbow sign. No more water. The fire next time. News of the Cuban Missile Crisis prematurely ended Baldwin's lecture, but later he gave a powerful speech at a hastily organized anti-war rally on Brandeis' campus. Davis was there listening intently to Baldwin, and then to Brandeis' sophisticated Marxist philosopher, who would become her intellectual mentor and who was fast becoming the intellectual mentor of the rapidly organizing New Left, Herbert Marcuse. Davis listened intently again when yet another towering mentor of the 1960s youth came to speak at Brandeis. Davis could not relate to Malcolm X's religious deprecations of whites, but she was fascinated, she later said, by his description of the way black people had internalized the racial inferiority thrust upon us by a white supremacist society. By her junior year, Davis had gone to study in France, only to be thrust tragically back to Dynamite Hill by the murder of those four girls. Davis did not view the Birmingham church bombing on September 15, 1963, as an isolated incident carried out by Southern white extremists. It was this spectacular, violent event, the savage dismembering of four little girls, which has burst out of the daily, sometimes even dull routine of racist oppression, in Davis's words. But Davis's classmates in France, indoctrinated by the mythology of the anti-racist North and racist South, refused to accept her persisting analysis of why the whole ruling stratum in their country, by being guilty of racism, was also guilty of this murder. The 19-year-old Angela Davis was hardly alone in the world in her analysis of American race relations. The Birmingham murders signified the massive resistance to the civil rights movement and the naked ugliness of American racism. As the brutality turned negative eyes to the United States and the decolonizing world, the stakes were raised for civil rights legislation to reassure the American freedom brand, forcing Kennedy's hand. President Kennedy announced his deep sense of outrage and grief over the Birmingham bombing. He launched an investigation which caused his Southern approval ratings to dip. Kennedy tried to boost his ratings 2 weeks later on a trip to Dallas. He never made it back to Washington. On November 27, 1963, 2 days after JFK's burial, the 36th president of the United States buried any lingering global fears that civil rights legislation had died with Kennedy. No memorial, oration, or eulogy could more eloquently honor President Kennedy's memory than the earliest possible passage of the Civil Rights Bill for which he fought so long, declared Lyndon Baines Johnson to Congress. Civil rights had hardly topped Kennedy's agenda, but activists and diplomats felt relieved. On March 26, 1964, Martin Luther King Jr. and Malcolm X came to watch the debate over the Civil Rights Bill, meeting for the first and only known time at the U.S. Capitol. Malcolm had recently been pushed out of the corrupted Nation of Islam. When he left Washington, he started warning American racists of the ballot or the bullet. At a church in Detroit on April 12, 1964, Malcolm offered his plan for the ballot instead of the bullet, going before the United Nations to charge the United States with violating the human rights of African Americans. Now you tell me, how can the plight of everybody on this earth reach the halls of the United Nations, Malcolm said, his voice rising, and you have 22 million Afro-Americans whose churches are being bombed, whose little girls are being murdered, whose leaders are being shot down in broad daylight, and America still had the audacity or the nerve to stand up and represent himself as the leader of the free world. With the blood of your and my mothers and fathers on his hands, with the blood dripping down his jaws like a bloody-jawed wolf. The day after the Detroit speech, Malcolm, who was Muslim, boarded a plane and embarked on his obligatory Hajj to Mecca. After a lifetime in the theater of American racism that began with the lynching of his father, Malcolm X on this trip saw for the first time all colors, from blue-eyed blondes to black-skinned Africans, interacting as equals. The experience changed him. The true Islam has shown me that a blanket indictment of all white people is as wrong as when whites make blanket indictments against blacks, he said. From then on, he took on the racist wolves and devils, no matter their skin color. Though American media outlets reported his change, the narrative of Malcolm X as hating white people endured. Malcolm returned to the States on May 21st in the middle of the longest filibuster in the Senate's history, 57 days. The senators who drove the filibuster were trying to stop the Civil Rights Act of 1964. Behind the scenes, supporters of the act agreed on outlawing future discrimination, but disagreed on what to do about past discrimination. Anti-racists requested that the act's fair employment provisions eliminate the established seniority rights of white workers. Assimilationists balked at the idea, while segregationists tried to make the request into a wedge issue. Segregationists knew white Americans were commonly refusing to acknowledge the accumulated gains of past discrimination, and nothing signified those gains in the labor market better than seniority. But the bill's powerful assimilationist backers were adamant that it would not affect white seniority. We don't think that one form of injustice can be corrected or should be corrected by creating another, AFL-CIO lawyer Thomas E. Harris said. Equating measures that healed inequities with measures that created inequities, it was as ridiculous as equating the harmful crime with a harmful punishment. Harris believed that taking away whites' seniority would be unjust to the white workers who had been building seniority in their jobs for many years. However, not to do so would be unjust to the Negro workers who had been discriminated against for just as long. Not tackling the seniority question and past discrimination would be akin to asking the Negro to enter the 100-yard dash 40 yards behind the starting line, argued the General Counsel for the Congress of Racial Equality, CORE, Carl Racklin. But that was what the writers of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 were largely asking the Negro to do. And when the Negro lost the dashes and the racial disparities persisted, racists could blame the supposed slowness of the Negro, not the head starts of accumulated white privilege. And so, as much as the Civil Rights Act served to erect a dam against Jim Crow policies, it also opened the floodgates for new racist ideas to pour in, including the most racist idea to date. It was an idea that ignored the white head start, presumed that discrimination had been eliminated, presumed that equal opportunity had taken over, and figured that since blacks were still losing the race, the racial disparities and their continued losses must be their fault. Black people must be inferior in equalizing policies, like eliminating or reducing white seniority or instituting affirmative action policies would be unjust and ineffective. The Civil Rights Act of 1964 managed to bring on racial progress and progression of racism at the same time. The most transformative verbiage of the 1964 Act was the wording that legislated against clear and obvious intention to discriminate, such as Southern whites-only public policies. But what about those Northern discriminators with private policies that had long kept blacks out? What about those who were still blockbusting and segregating Northern cities and still creating, maintaining, and increasing racial inequities in wealth, housing, and education? If the Northern backers of the Act defined policies as racist by their public outcomes instead of their public intent, then they would be hard-pressed to maintain the myth of the anti-racist North and the racist South. By not principally focusing on outcome, discriminators had to merely privatize their public policies to get around the Civil Rights Act, and that is precisely what they did. Though the congressmen were aware of these privatizing forces, they chose not to explicitly bar seemingly race-neutral policies that had discriminatory public outcomes through racial disparities. On the urgings of segregationists, in fact, Congress actually provided the means for the progression of racism. Section 703H of Title VII allowed employers to give and to act upon the results of any professionally developed ability test. Though eugenicists had been discounted in mainstream America, Congress and their constituents had thoroughly embraced their standardized mental tests as having the capacity to assess what did not exist, general intelligence. In the job industry, in education, and in many other sectors of society, officials could justify their racial disparities by pointing to test scores and claiming they were not intending to discriminate. And to racist Americans, the racial gaps in the scores, the so-called achievement gap, said something was wrong with the black test takers, not the tests. The Civil Rights Act of 1964 was the first important civil rights legislation since the Civil Rights Act of 1875. It outlawed public, intentional discrimination on the basis of race, color, religion, sex, or national origin in government agencies and facilities, public accommodations, education and employment, established a federal enforcement structure, and empowered victims of discrimination to sue and the government to withhold federal funds from violators. Hours after President Johnson signed it into law on July 2, 1964, he appeared before television cameras to play up the American ideal of freedom for cynics in Los Angeles and Lagos and Lhasa. "Today in far corners of distant continents," he proclaimed, "the ideals of those American patriots still shape the struggles of men who hunger for freedom." Malcolm X had another take on the Civil Rights Act, echoing the thoughts of anti-racist young minds like Angela Davis's. "If the government cannot enforce the existing laws," he asked the Organization of African Unity Conference in 1964, "how can anyone be so naive as to think all the additional laws brought into being by the Civil Rights Bill will be enforced?" The passage of the Civil Rights Act in 1964 hardly hurt Lyndon B. Johnson's commanding position for re-election during that election year. Johnson did face an improbable challenge for the Democratic nomination from Alabama Governor George Wallace, however. After taking a public stand for segregation the year before, Wallace had received more than 100,000 approving letters, mostly from Northerners. Wallace realized, as he told NBC's Douglas Kiker, "They all hate black people. That's it. The whole United States is Southern." During his campaign, George Wallace sounded more like the 1964 Republican nominee than LBJ. Arizona Senator Barry Goldwater's nomination for president signified his star power over the escalating conservative movement in American politics, powered by his 1960 chart topper, "The Conscience of a Conservative," inspiring millions of Democrats to turn Republican, including Hollywood movie star Ronald Reagan. Goldwater's tract deeply massaged those Americans who had outgrown, or never needed, government assistance. Welfare transforms the individual from a dignified, industrious, self-reliant, spiritual being into a dependent animal creature without his knowing it, Goldwater wrote without a shred of evidence. Many proud, dignified, industrious, self-reliant members of the white middle class who had derived their wealth from the welfare of inheritance, the New Deal, or the GI Bill, accepted Goldwater's dictum as truth, despite the fact that parental or government assistance had not transformed them or their parents into dependent animal creatures. After looking at white mothers on welfare as deserving for decades, these Goldwater conservatives saw the growing number of black mothers on welfare as undeserving, as dependent animal creatures. Barry Goldwater and his embryonic conservative movement hardly worried Johnson as he arrived on the beaches of Atlantic City for the Democratic National Convention in August 1964. But he was worried about those northern activists who had violently protested against police brutality and economic exploitation in urban summer rebellions from Harlem to Chicago. In the South, SNCC field agents had weathered Klan brutality during their Mississippi Freedom Summer, which brought hundreds of northern college students to teach in anti-racist freedom schools and assist in organizing the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party, MFDP. The interracial MFDP came to Atlantic City and requested to be seated in place of the regular Mississippi delegation, which everyone knew had been elected through fraud and violence. The MFDP's electrifying vice chair, Fannie Lou Hamer, riveted the nation in her live televised testimony at the convention. "If the Freedom Democratic Party is not seated now, I question America. Is this America, the land of the free and the home of the brave, where we have to sleep with our telephones off the hook because our lives be threatened daily because we want to live as decent human beings?" President Johnson called an emergency press conference to divert the networks away from Hamer's transfixing testimony, and then later he offered the Freedom Party a compromise, two non-voting seats accompanying the segregationist delegation. "We didn't come all this way for no two seats," bellowed Fannie Lou Hamer. MFDP and SNCC activists traveled home carrying a valuable lesson about power politics. Persuasion does not work. "Things could never be the same," SNCC's Cleveland Sellers recalled. "Never again were we lulled into believing that our task was exposing injustices so that the good people of America could eliminate them. After Atlantic City, our struggle was not for civil rights, but for liberation." Malcolm X's empowerment philosophy of black national and international unity, self-determination, self-defense, and cultural pride started to sound like music to the ears of the SNCC youths. At the end of 1964, Malcolm X returned from an extended trip to Africa with a growing band of SNCC admirers and a growing band of enemies. On February 21st, 1965, Malcolm X was gunned down by some of those enemies at a Harlem rally. When James Baldwin heard the news in London, he was beside himself. "It is because of you," he shouted at London reporters, "the men that created this white supremacy, that this man is dead." From his nationally watched voting registration campaign in Selma, Alabama, Martin Luther King Jr. was reflectively restrained. "While we did not always see eye to eye on methods to solve the race problem, I always had a deep affection for Malcolm and felt that he had a great ability to put his finger on the existence and root of the problem." On February 22, 1965, the New York Times banner headline read, "The Apostle of Hate is Dead." Actor Ozzie Davis christened Malcolm "Our Shining Black Prince" days later in his magnetic eulogy before the overflow crowd at Harlem's Faith Temple of the Church of God in Christ. "Many will say he is of hate, a fanatic, a racist," Davis said. And the response would be, "Did you ever really listen to him? For if you did, you would know him. And if you knew him, you would know why we must honor him." Anti-racist Americans did honor him, especially after recordings and transcripts of his speeches began to circulate, and after Grove Press published the autobiography of Malcolm X. Journalist Alex Haley had collaborated with Malcolm to write the autobiography, which was billed by Elliot Freeman Smith of the New York Times as a brilliant, painful, important book upon its release in November 1965. Malcolm X's ideological transformation from assimilationist to anti-white separatist to anti-racist inspired millions. Possibly no other American autobiography opened more anti-racist minds than the autobiography of Malcolm X. Malcolm condemned the half-truth of racial progress, bellowing that you don't stick a knife in a person's back 9 inches, pull it out 6 inches, and say you're making progress. The black man's supposed to be grateful? Why, if the white man jerked the knife out, it's still gonna leave a scar. He argued that white people were not born racist, but that the American political, economic, and social atmosphere automatically nourishes a racist psychology in the white man. He encouraged anti-racist whites who had escaped racism to fight on the battle lines of where America's racism really is, and that's in their own home communities. He ferociously attacked the white man's puppet Negro leaders who had exploited their black poor brothers and who did not want separation or integration, but only to live in an open, free society where they can walk with their heads up like men and women. But nothing was more compelling than Malcolm X's unstinting humanism. I'm for truth, no matter who tells it. I'm for justice, no matter who it is for or against. I'm a human being first and foremost, and as such, I'm for whoever and whatever benefits humanity as a whole. Anti-racist Americans had some reason to hope for justice when Congress took up the Voting Rights Bill after hundreds of marchers were bludgeoned on a bridge outside of Selma on March 7, 1965. Yet even with a Voting Rights Bill, the United States would not be finished. President Johnson had the courage to declare in his commencement address to Howard University graduates in June, "You do not take a person who, for years, has been hobbled by chains and liberate him, bring him up to the starting line of a race, and then say, 'You are free to compete with all the others,' and still justly believe that you have been completely fair." It was quite possibly the most anti-racist avowal ever uttered from the lips of a U.S. president. And Johnson was just getting started. "We seek not just freedom, but opportunity," he said. "We seek not just legal equity, but human ability, not just equality as a right and a theory, but equality as a fact and equality as a result." Racial progress had come primarily for a growing middle-class minority, while for poor blacks, Johnson said, the walls are rising and the gulf is widening. In Johnson's time, in the midst of civil rights legislation, racial disparities in unemployment had grown, income disparities had grown, and disparities in poverty, in infant mortality, and in urban segregation had all grown, as he pointed out at Howard University. Why had all this happened? Johnson offered two broad, basic reasons. One, anti-racist, inherited poverty and the devastating legacy of discrimination, and one, racist, the devastation wrought by the breakdown of the Negro family structure. Johnson's Howard address raised the hopes of civil rights leaders, and it delighted Johnson's Assistant Secretary of Labor, Daniel Patrick Moynihan, who's Beyond the Melting Pot was still widely read in urban sociology. Moynihan, in fact, had composed Johnson's speech with the ideas still fresh in his mind from an unpublished government report he had just completed. Moynihan's The Negro Family, The Case for National Action, which had reached Johnson's desk by May 1965, statistically demonstrated that civil rights legislation over the past 10 years had not improved the living conditions of most African Americans. But then, after all these anti-racist revelations about the progression of racism, Moynihan had rambled into assimilationist ideas. He argued that discrimination had forced the Negro family into a matriarchal structure which, because it is so out of line with the rest of the American society, seriously retards the progress of the group as a whole, and imposes a crushing burden on the Negro male and, in consequence, on a great many Negro women as well. Moynihan ended up following E. Franklin Frazier, his main scholarly source, in judging female-headed families as inferior in sexist fashion, and in judging the black family as a tangle of pathology in racist fashion. He portrayed black men as emasculated by discrimination. And since they were overburdened from assuming their societal roles as heads of households, they were more oppressed than black women. They needed, Moynihan pleaded, national action. On August 6, 1965, around the time the Moynihan Report was leaked to the press, Johnson signed the momentous Voting Rights Act. Discriminators seeking a way around the Civil Rights Act of 1964 could have easily learned some lessons from voting discriminators, who had been hiding their intent for 6 or 7 decades in their literacy tests, poll taxes, and grandfather clauses, which were all void of racial language. The Voting Rights Act of 1965 not only banned these seemingly race-neutral policies, which had almost totally disenfranchised Southern blacks, but also required that all changes to Southern voting laws now be approved by a federal official, who would ensure that they would not have the effect of denying or abridging the right to vote on account of race or color. The intent-focused Civil Rights Act of 1964 was not nearly as effective as the outcome-focused Voting Rights Act of 1965. In Mississippi alone, black voter turnout increased from 6% in 1964 to 59% in 1969. The Voting Rights Act ended up becoming the most effective piece of anti-racist legislation ever passed by the Congress of the United States of America. But the act was not without its loopholes. We recognize that increased voting strength might encourage a shift in the tactics of discrimination, Attorney General Nicholas Katzenbach testified to Congress. Once significant numbers of blacks could vote, communities could still throw up obstacles to discourage those voters or make it difficult for a black to win elective office. Katzenbach's recognition of the fact that racist policies could progress in the face of racial progress proved prophetic. Chapter 31. Black Power. It did not take long for the renewed progression of racism to show itself. On August 9, 1965, 3 days after Johnson signed the Voting Rights Act, Newsweek alarmed Americans by disclosing the findings of the leaked Moynihan Report. The rising rate of non-white illegitimacy, the runaway curve in child welfare cases, and the social roots of the American dilemma of race were all from the splintering Negro family. A photograph of Harlem kids tossing bottles contained the caption, "A time bomb ticks in the ghetto." The time bomb exploded 2 days later in the Watts neighborhood of Los Angeles, when a police incident set off 6 days of violence, the deadliest and most destructive urban rebellion in history. In its aftermath, the victimized mockingbird that had attracted so much paternalist compassion in the past few years became the aggressive panther that needed to be controlled. As Watts burned, Angela Davis boarded a boat headed for Germany. She had come back from France, studied under philosopher Herbert Marcuse, and graduated from Brandeis. Now she was headed to Marcuse's intellectual home of Frankfurt to pursue her graduate studies in philosophy. She felt again the tension of the Janus head. Leaving the country at the time was hard for me, as she later said. But the anti-racist struggle was globalizing, as she learned in France and would learn again in Germany. Shortly after she arrived, in September 1965, an international group of scholars gathered due north in Copenhagen for the Race and Color Conference. Davis apparently did not attend, but if she had, she would have heard lectures on the racist role of language symbolism. Scholars pointed out everyday phrases like black sheep, blackballing, black male, and blacklisting, among others, that had long associated blackness and negativity. The language symbolism was no less striking in two new American identifiers, minority and ghetto. For centuries, racists had construed black folk as minors to white majors, and that history could be easily loaded into their latest identifier of the supposed lesser peoples, minorities. The appellation only made sense as a numerical term, and as a numerical term, it only made sense indicating national population or power dynamics. But it quickly became a racial identifier of African Americans and other non-whites, even in discussions that had nothing to do with national issues. It made no sense as another name for black people, since most black people lived, schooled, worked, socialized, and died in majority black spaces. The term only made sense from the viewpoint of whites, who commonly related to black people as the numerical minority in their majority white spaces, and elite blacks who were more likely to exist as the numerical minority in majority white spaces. And so, class racism, downgrading the viewpoint of black commoners in majority black spaces, became wrapped up in the term minority, not unlike a term that psychologist Kenneth Clark had popularized after putting aside brown and light dolls. In 1965, Clark published his seminal text, Dark Ghetto. The term ghetto was known as an identifier of the ruthlessly segregated Jewish communities in Nazi Germany. Though social scientists like Clark hoped the term would broadcast the ruthless segregation and poverty that urban blacks faced, the word quickly assumed a racist life of its own. Ghetto and black would become as interchangeable in the racist mind by the end of the century as minority and black, and as interchangeable as ghetto and inferior, minority and inferior, ghetto and low class, and ghetto and unrefined. In these dark ghettos lived ghetto people, expressing ghetto culture, who were so ghetto, meaning that the neighborhoods, the people, and the culture were inferior, low class, and unrefined. Class racists and some suburban Americans saw little distinction between impoverished black urban neighborhoods, black working class urban neighborhoods, and black middle class urban neighborhoods. They were all ghettos with dangerous black hooligans who rioted for more welfare. On January 9, 1966, the New York Times Magazine contrasted these rioting ghetto blacks with a model minority, Asians. Some Asian Americans consumed the racist model minority title, which masked the widespread discrimination and poverty in Asian American communities and regarded Asian Americans as superior in their assimilating prowess to Latinos, Native Americans, and African Americans. Anti-racist Asian Americans rejected the concept of the model minority and fermented the Asian American movement in the late 1960s. Assimilationists were loading the terms model minority and ghetto with negatively racist associations in 1966. Meanwhile, activists were quickly extracting negative associations from the identifier black, foremost among them Stokely Carmichael. Carmichael had been born in Trinidad in 1941. And his family had moved to Harlem in 1952, the same year his idol, Malcolm X, was paroled from prison. In 1964, Carmichael graduated from Howard University. By then, Malcolm's disciples, Carmichael included, were loading the old identifier, Negro, with accommodation and assimilation, and removing ugliness and evil from the old identifier, black. They were now passionately embracing the term black, which stunned Martin Luther King Jr.'s Negro disciples and their own assimilationist parents and grandparents, who would rather be called nigger than black. As the new chairman of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, Stokely Carmichael was one of the leaders of the Mississippi March Against Fear in the summer of 1966, alongside King and Floyd McKissick of the Congress of Racial Equality. The massive march careened through Mississippi towns, battling segregationist resistors, mobilizing and organizing locals, and registering the latter to vote. On June 16, 1966, the March Against Fear stopped in Greenwood, Mississippi, one of the buckles of the belt of majority black southern counties still ruled by armed white minorities. "We've been saying freedom for 6 years, and we ain't got nothing," Carmichael shouted at a Greenwood rally. "What we gonna start saying now is black power. What do you want?" Carmichael screamed. "Black power," the powerless Greenville blacks screamed back. Quickly blown by the fans of the American media, the Maxim whisked through all the majority black urban areas and rural counties that were politically controlled, economically exploited, and culturally denigrated by white assimilationists and segregationists. Anti-racists, reading Malcolm's autobiography, had been looking for a concept to wrap around their demands for black control of black communities. They latched onto black power as firmly in the North as they did in the South, and Martin Luther King Jr. learned why later in the summer. After an open housing march on August 5, 1966, through a fuming white neighborhood in Chicago, King told reporters he had never seen as much hatred and hostility on the part of so many people. There was nothing more democratic than saying that the majority, in this case, the disempowered black majority, should rule their own local communities, should have black power. But just as sexists could only envision male or female supremacy, northern and southern races could only envision white or black supremacy. And the 20 urban rebellions that ensued in the summer of 1966 only confirmed for many races that black power meant blacks violently establishing black supremacy and slaughtering their oppressors. Time, the Saturday Evening Post, the U.S. News and World Report, the New York Post, and the Progressive are a few of the many periodicals that condemned the start of the Black Power movement. Even prominent black leaders criticized black power. Roy Wilkins of the NAACP sang from the hymnal of assimilationist comebacks to anti-racist ideas. He redefined the anti-racist idea as segregationist and attacked his own redefinition. No matter how endlessly they try to explain it, the term black power means anti-white power, Wilkins charged at the NAACP's annual convention on July 5, 1966. It is a reverse Mississippi, a reverse Hitler, a reverse Ku Klux Klan. Vice President Hubert Humphrey added his two licks at the convention. Yes, racism is racism, and there is no room in America for racism of any color. Riding the opposition to black power, Goldwater Republicans made substantial gains in the midterm elections of 1966. Carmichael did not stop promoting black power, however. He traveled around the nation in the final months of 1966 to build the movement. In October, he gave the keynote address at a black power conference at the University of California at Berkeley. In nearby Oakland that month, two community college students, incensed that their peers were not living up to Malcolm X's directives, had organized their own two-man Black Power conference. Huey P. Newton and Bobby Seale composed the 10-point platform for their newly founded Black Panther Party for Self-Defense, demanding the power to determine the destiny of our black community, full employment, decent housing, reparations, an immediate end to police brutality and murder of black people, freedom for all black prisoners, and peace, quoting Jefferson's Declaration of Independence. In the next few years, the Black Panther Party grew in chapters across the country, attracting thousands of committed and charismatic young community servants. They policed the police, provided free breakfast for children, and organized medical services and political education programs, among a series of other initiatives. The growth of the Black Panther Party and other black power organizations in 1967 reflected the fact that black youngsters had realized that civil rights persuasion and lobbying tactics had failed to loosen the suffocating stranglehold of police brutalizers, tyrannical slumlords, neglectful school boards, and exploitive businessmen. But nothing reflected that realization and that effort to release the stranglehold more than the nearly 130 violent black rebellions from coast to coast between March and September that year. And yet racist psychiatrists announced that these rioters suffered from schizophrenia, which they defined as a black disease that manifested in rage. To Moynihan Report reading sociologists, the male rioters were raging from their emasculation. Meanwhile, racist criminologists suggested that the rioters were exuding urban blacks' subculture of violence, a phrase Marvin Wolfgang used in 1967 for his classic criminology textbook. A band of shrewd Goldwater politicians proclaimed that the lazy rioters demonstrated the need to reduce the welfare rolls and impose work requirements. But welfare mothers resisted. In September, the newly formed National Welfare Rights Association, NWRO, staged a sit-in in the chambers of the Senate Finance Committee, causing Louisiana Senator Russell Long to blast the association as Black Brood Mares, Inc. Congress still passed the first mandatory work requirement for welfare recipients. Angela Davis grew restless in Frankfurt, Germany, reading about the surging black power movement, being forced to experience it all vicariously. Davis decided to return to the United States during the summer of 1967. She arranged to finish her doctorate at the University of California at San Diego, where philosopher Herbert Marcuse was teaching after being politically muscled out of Brandeis. In late July, on her way home, she stopped in London to attend the Dialectics of Liberation conference, where Marcuse and Carmichael were the featured speakers. Her natural hairstyle stood out like a signpost, and she quickly nestled in with the small black power contingent. When Davis arrived in Southern California, she was itching to get involved in the black power movement. Like black power activists everywhere, she brought the movement to her backyard. She helped build UC San Diego's Black Student Union. That fall, Wherever there were black students, they were building BSUs or taking over student governments, requesting and demanding an anti-racist and relevant education at historically black and historically white colleges. The black student is demanding a shaking from the roots-up overhaul of their colleges, reported the Chicago Defender. In November, Davis took the short trip up to Watts to attend the Black Youth Conference. Walking into the Second Baptist Church, she noticed the colorful African fabrics on the energetic and smiling young women and men who were calling each other sister and brother. It was her first real black power gathering in the States. She felt exhilarated seeing black as so beautiful. Taking in the workshops, Davis learned that the minds of the attendees were as colorfully different as their adornments. Some activists were articulating Du Bois's old anti-racist socialism, delighting Davis. Other activists talked about their back-to-Africa separatist, anti-white, community service, or revolutionary aspirations. Some FBI agents posing as activists aspired to collect notes and broaden the ideological fissures. Some activists aspire to ferment a cultural revolution, destroying assimilationist ideas and revitalizing African or African-American culture. Black power appealed to activists of many ideological stripes. Black power even appealed to the face of the civil rights movement. Indeed, the civil rights movement was transforming into the black power movement in 1967, if not before. No Lincolnian Emancipation Proclamation, no Johnsonian civil rights bill could bring about complete psychological freedom, boomed Martin Luther King Jr. at the annual convention of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, SCLC, on August 16th. The Negro must say to himself and to the world, "I'm black, but I'm black and beautiful." King brought on a chilling applause from SCLC activists who waved signs that read, "Black is beautiful, and it is so beautiful to be black." King made his way out of the good graces of assimilationist America that year. Assimilationists still wanted to keep him in the doubly conscious dreams of 1963, just as they had wanted to keep Du Bois in the doubly conscious souls of 1903. But King no longer saw any real strategic utility for the persuasion techniques that assimilationists adored, or for the desegregation efforts they championed. He now realized that desegregation had primarily benefited black elites, leaving millions wallowing in the wrenching poverty that had led to their urban rebellions. King, therefore, switched gears and began planning the SCLC's Poor People's Campaign. His goal was to bring poor people to the nation's capital in order to force the federal government to pass an economic bill of rights, committing to full employment, guaranteed income, and affordable housing, a bill that sounded eerily similar to the economic proposals on the Black Panther Party's 10-point platform. The title of King's speech at the SCLC convention was the title of the book he released in the fall of 1967, Where Do We Go From Here? When a people are mired in oppression, they realize deliverance only when they have accumulated the power to enforce change, King wrote. Power is not the white man's birthright. It will not be legislated for us and delivered in neat government packages. The road to lasting progress was civil disobedience, not persuasion, King maintained. He bravely critiqued the all-powerful Moynihan Report, warning about the danger that problems would be attributed to innate Negro weaknesses and used to justify neglect and rationalize oppression. Moynihan assimilationists responded to King as firmly as they responded to segregationists, classifying the SCLC's Poor People's Campaign and King as extremist. King, they said, had become an anarchist. His own critique of anti-racists as extremists and anarchists in his Birmingham letter 4 years earlier had boomeranged back to hit him. King's book seemed to complement Stokely Carmichael's co-authored Black Power, The Politics of Liberation in America, published shortly after Where Do We Go From Here. Carmichael and scholar Charles Hamilton gave innovative new names to two kinds of racism. They named and contrasted individual racism, which assimilationists regarded as the principal problem, and which assimilationists believe could be remedied by persuasion and education, and institutional racism, the institutional policies and collections of individual prejudices that anti-racists regarded as the principal problem, and that anti-racists believed only power could remedy. And white American power did not appear up to the task. On January 17, 1968, President Johnson submitted his State of the Union to Congress. Representatives and senators and their constituents were raging not against discrimination, but against all the protests, whether nonviolent or violent, opposing the Vietnam War, racism, exploitation, and inequality. When Johnson thundered that the American people have had enough of rising crime and lawlessness, the applause was deafening. After three straight summers of urban rebellions, some of those applauding the speech, both in the Capitol and around the country, actually feared that a violent black revolution could be on the horizon. And their fears were reflected in a new blockbuster film that broke box office records weeks after Johnson's address. When white astronauts land on a planet after a 2,000-year journey, apes enslave them. One astronaut escapes, and in one of the iconic scenes in Hollywood history, at the end of the movie, he comes upon a rusted Statue of Liberty. The astronaut, Charlton Heston, and the viewers realize with dismay that he is not light years from home, but back on Earth. Planet of the Apes took the place of Tarzan in racist popular culture, inspiring four sequels between 1970 and 1973, three more in the 21st century, a television series, and a host of comic books, video games, and other merchandise. You name it, the franchise produced it. While Tarzan put on America's screens, the racist confidence of conquering the dark world that prevailed in the first half of the 20th century, Planet of the Apes held up in full color the racist panic during the second half of the 20th century of the conquered dark world rising up to enslave the white conqueror. By 1968, both Democrats and Republicans had popularized the call for law and order. It became a motto for defending the planet of the whites. Law and order rhetoric was used as a defense for police brutality, and both the rhetoric and the brutality triggered urban rebellions that in turn triggered more rhetoric and brutality. And no one could explain all of this better in early 1968 than a giant of a man and thinker and writer, the former convict turned Malcolm X disciple, Eldridge Cleaver, who had become Minister of Information for the Black Panther Party. The police are the armed guardians of the social order. The blacks are the chief domestic victims of the social order, Cleaver explained. A conflict of interests exists, therefore, between the blacks and the police. Cleaver penned these words in what seemingly became the most heralded literary response of the era to the mobilizing law and order movement. In vividly angry, funny, disgusting, lucidly insightful detail, Cleaver described a black soul which has been colonized by an oppressive white society. Released in February 1968, 1 million copies of Soul on Ice were sold in no time. The New York Times named the part memoir, part social commentary, one of the top 10 books of the year. Soul on Ice was timely and frigidly controversial. Cleaver mused in the book on his blood-curdling transformation from a practice-run rapist of black women to an insurrectionary rapist of white women and finally to an optimistic human rights revolutionary. If a man like Malcolm X could change and repudiate racism, if I myself and other former Muslims can change, if young whites can change, then there is hope for America, he concluded. Cleaver's book became the manifesto of black power masculinity to redeem the tragic colonized male, whose soul was on ice, whose being was the black eunuch. The book demonstrated that black power masculinity had in fact accepted the racist idea of the emasculated black man, an idea popularized by the ever-popular Moynihan Report of 1965. For all his anti-racist strikes on assimilationist ideas, prisons, and policing, for all his anti-racist Marxist strikes on white supremacist capitalism and the black bourgeoisie, Cleaver's queer racism and gender racism were striking. Black homosexuals were doubly emasculated, and thus inferior to singularly emasculated white homosexuals. They were emasculated as black men and emasculated through the sickness of homosexuality, Cleaver argued. In Cleaver's gender racism, the black woman and the white man were silent allies. The white man placed the white woman on a pedestal and turned the black woman into a strong, self-reliant Amazon. And yet Cleaver ended Soul on Ice with an impassioned love letter to all black women from all black men. Across the naked abyss of negated masculinity, of 400 years minus my balls, We face each other today, my queen, Cleaver wrote. I have returned from the dead. For all of his gender racism, Cleaver was still uniquely anti-racist in his regal attraction to black women, and especially to his new wife, Kathleen Cleaver, the Black Panther Party's national communications secretary. A product of a globe-trotting military family, civil rights activism, and SNCC, Kathleen was the first woman to enter the Panthers' Central Committee. To all those black men refusing to date or appreciate black women and viewing white women as superior, Eldridge was unequivocal in his disdain. This new generation of Jack Johnsons were shrewdly understood by the Martinique-born psychiatrist Frantz Fanon, who had married a French woman before becoming one of the godfathers of black power masculinity by authoring the anti-colonial grenade, The Wretched of the Earth, 1961. By loving me, the white woman proves I am worthy of white love, Fanon wrote in Black Skin, White Masks, 1952. I am loved like a white man. I am a white man. When my restless hands caress those white breasts, they grasp white civilization. And these black assimilationist men, desiring to be white men, and constantly justifying that desire through imagining the wrongs of black women, were quite numerous inside and outside of the black power movement in the late 1960s. Black men sought out white women because black women's intense self-rejection caused them to stop seeking male attention and let themselves go, as black psychiatrist William Greer, father of comedian David Allen Greer, and Price Cobbs argued in an influential 1968 text, Black Rage. Beliefs in pathological black femininity and masculinity informed beliefs in the pathological black family, which informed beliefs in pathological African-American culture. They were like legs holding up the seat of America's racist ideas. Sociologist Andrew Billingsley was one of the first scholars to strike at those legs. His seminal study, Black Families in White America, broke the ground on anti-racist black family studies in 1968. He refused to analyze black families from the criteria of white families. Unlike Moynihan and others, we do not view the Negro as a causal nexus in a tangle of pathologies, which feeds on itself, he wrote. Instead, he viewed the black family as an absorbing, adaptive, and amazingly resilient mechanism for the socialization of its children. Billingsley made the same case about African-American culture. To say that a people have no culture is to say that they have no common history which has shaped and taught them, Billingsley argued. And to deny the history of a people is to deny their humanity. On February 29, 1968, as Americans were reading Soul on Ice, the National Advisory Commission on Civil Disorders released its final report on the urban rebellions of 1967. Back in July, Johnson created the commission to answer the questions, what happened? Why did it happen? What can be done to prevent it from happening again and again? With the 9 white and 2 black investigators representing groups hostile to black power and touting the new status quo motto, law and order, anti-racists did not expect much from the Kerner Commission, named after its chair, Illinois Governor Otto Kerner Jr. The conclusions of the Kerner Commission shocked the United States like the rebellions it investigated. The commission members unabashedly blamed racism for the urban rebellions. It said, what white Americans have never fully understood, but what the Negro can never forget, is that white society is deeply implicated in the ghetto. White institutions created it, white institutions maintain it, and white society condones it. The racist mainstream media had failed America, the report concluded. The press has too long basked in a white world looking out of it, if at all, with white men's eyes and white perspective. In the afterglow of the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act, as United States proclaimed racial progress, the Kerner Commission proclaimed the progression of racism in its most famous passage, our nation is moving towards two societies, one black, one white, separate and unequal. Everyone seemed to have an opinion about the 426-page document, and it was purchased by more than 2 million Americans. Richard Nixon blasted the report for exonerating the rioters, as did the racists whom Nixon was attracting to his presidential campaign. Martin Luther King Jr., in the midst of organizing his Poor People's Campaign, christened the report a physician's warning of approaching death with a prescription for life. President Johnson felt that his own physicians had overblown white racism, and he was probably worried about the report's damaging effects on the half-truth of racial progress and the costs of its prescription for life. The report recommended the allocation of billions of dollars to diversify American policing, to provide new jobs, better schools, and more welfare to poor black communities, and to eradicate